And the next distinguished, powerful, inspirational, trailblazing pioneer that I'm going to introduce will be our keynote speaker for tonight, the Honorable Judge Brenda F. Harvin Forte. Judge Brenda F. Harvin Forte was appointed to the Alameda County Municipal Court in January 1992 and became an Alameda County Superior Court Judge in July of 1998. She received her bachelor's degree from UC Berkeley in 1976 and her law degree from UC Berkeley's Oak Hall School in 1979. You're going to hear a lot of firsts as I read about Judge Brenda Harvin Forte. Following a clerkship on the central staff of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, she joined Harris, Alexander, and Burris, a small Oakland firm where she handled civil and criminal cases in state and federal courts. On January 1, 1992, she became the first African-American woman president of the Alameda County Bar Association, but she served for only a few days because on January 24th of that same year, Governor Pete Wilson appointed her to the bench. Judge Harvin Forte currently serves as Judicial Advisor North to the California Association of the Black Lawyers. She's also served as the presiding judge at the Alameda County Juvenile Court and was the county's first woman judge to hold that title. All right now. In 2003, she was named the Juvenile Court Judge of the Year by the California Judges Association, Juvenile Court Judges of California, and she served as a member of the California Judicial Council, chairing the council's Rules and Projects Committee. Judge Harvin Forte has been at the forefront of efforts to improve diversity in the judiciary. As chair of the court's working group of the State Bar's Diversity Pipeline Task Force, she convened a first ever statewide summit on judicial diversity. Judge Harvin Forte has received numerous awards and honors, numerous. Amongst them are the Charles Houston Bar Association's Judicial Excellence Award, the California Women Lawyers Rose Byrd Memorial Award, the Minority Bar Coalition's Champion of Unity Award, and many, 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 many more. Too many. We'll be here all night if I try to name all of them. I'll tell you, Judge Brenda Harvin Forte is one of the most down-to-earth individuals you will ever want to meet. She is a true mentor, a true leader, a true inspiration, and I've heard her speak before, and she blew everybody in the room away. Please join me in giving her a warm, warm, noble welcome, Judge Brenda Harvin Forte.
Good evening, good evening. First, I want to thank Jan for that wonderful and generous introduction. To your chapter president, Lieutenant Tony Duncan, to the other officers, to distinguished members, the national officers, honored guests, honorees, including my colleague, Trina Tyson. I want to tell you that it is with great humility that I stand here this evening as your keynote speaker. You know, it is actually said that a keynote speaker is someone who can take a two-minute idea and turn it into a two-hour talk. And you know, I guess that Jan, the gentleman, Jim Dunson, and Chief Jan Davis know that. Because when they invited me to speak, I was a little nervous about speaking, and I said, what should I talk about? And they said, in unison, they said, well, you know what, you should talk about 20 minutes and then you should sit down because we got a lot of stuff we got to do that. And I know that you can both imagine Joan and I and Jan saying that. But you know, first of all, to noble members, let me say thank you. I want to thank you for the risks that you take every day to make our community safer. I want to thank you for all the work that you do up and speaking out. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. And when I think about Noble, I can't help but think about what it means to be an African-American law enforcement officer. What it means to put on a uniform. And yes, I know that some of you are executives and you don't put on a uniform every day. But I want you to know that I think about when you put on your uniforms and you wear your badges and you go out into our communities to enforce the law, it's a lot like what judges do. And I have a theory, and I believe that it's one that applies equally to the black robes that judges wear and to your uniforms, because we're both charged with enforcing the law. And the law is important. I mean, even Dr. Martin Luther King says that it may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can stop him from lynching me. And I think that's pretty important. But I've said that there's a difference between the robes worn by African-American judges and the robes that are worn by other judges. And that difference is that our robes are heavier. No matter how many lightweight silk and other fabrics that we have are made of, our robes are heavier because when we put them on, we place upon our shoulders a rather unique history when it comes to justice. And we carry in our pockets a rather unique responsibility to the future. The unique history is one of legally sanctioned slavery and discrimination, of unfairness, of denial of justice in our courts. Indeed, blacks historically have felt that they simply would not find justice in our justice system. The unique responsibility to the future is that we judges carry in our pockets is to make sure that we keep wide open the doors that were forced open by those who came before us. Those who suffered the ridicule and the criticisms and the public scorn accompanying their efforts to ensure equal justice under the law. Our robes are heavier because each day we're confronted with fighting stereotypes about what we do and, more importantly, about why we're doing it. And I believe your law enforcement uniforms are heavier than those worn by other officers. That when you put them on, that you too put upon your shoulders our country's turbulent and schizophrenic history. You know that some hold the view that those uniforms represent a symbol of oppression, that you must also fight the stereotype that those uniforms make you just another player in a system that denies people their liberty and their freedom. Indeed, your conference theme that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere is a 1963 quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. They use that quote in his letter from a Birmingham jail, which he wrote while he was incarcerated. Now, Dr. King penned that letter to respond to members of the clergy who had questioned why was he in Birmingham, an outside agitator causing all of this confusion. And he told them in this letter that he was there because he'd been invited there. And he went on to say, and I want to quote, but more basically, I'm in Birmingham because injustice is here. Moreover, I'm cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We're caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. And certainly Dr. King had his share of atrocities at the hands of law enforcement in Birmingham, and particularly at the behest of that symbol of law enforcement, Bull Connor. And in recalling his struggles, Dr. King has talked about how Bull Connor would tell them to send the dogs for it, and they did come. But he says, we just went before the dogs singing, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Bull Connor next would say, turn the fire hoses on. And we went before the fire hoses. We had known water. If we were Baptist or some other denomination, we'd been immersed. If we were Methodist and some others, we'd been sprinkled. But we knew water. That couldn't stop us. And we just went on before the dogs, and we'd look at them. And we'd go on before the water hoses, and we'd look at them. And we'd just go on singing, over my head, I see freedom in the air. And then we'd be thrown in the paddy wagons. And sometimes we were stacked in there like sardines in a can. And they would throw us in, and old Bull would say, take them off. And they did. And we just go in a paddy wagon singing, "We Shall Overcome." And so we ended up transforming Bull into a steer, and we won our struggle in Birmingham. And no one knew that history when it was formed in 1976. When your group first met, you talked about fairness in the administration of justice, about police community relations, about the hiring and promotion of black police officers, and about the unique problems faced by black police executives. Noble wanted and needed a paradigm shift in the way law enforcement was perceived in our communities. And he knew that an organized voice of black law enforcement officers could bring about the needed change. And what an important role you have played and will play in bringing our communities together. Consider the fact that you are here even in Oakland, at a time when there's much strife and much distrust and much tension between the community and law enforcement officials. It is often said that we are placed exactly where we're supposed to be for the work of the greater good that must be done, that our steps are guided, that our path is already laid for us to follow, and we would just be obedient. And I suspect that your conference was planned in Oakland a long time ago, but you are here in Oakland at this very critical time because you have a message to deliver, and you have work to do that can bring about so much healing. And I don't know about you, but I find it pretty amazing. And as we judges have done, Noble members too have had to struggle with educating the community that they must be held accountable for their violations of the law, and that no one gets a free pass. We send a message that personal responsibility and accountability will apply equally without regard to skin color. And by the same token, just as we judges do, you know that a fair balance must be struck between competing interests and desires, and that all of those, including needs, must be harmonized. And more importantly, you realize and appreciate that as law enforcement executives, you must do your part to ensure equal protection of the law. And I imagine that when you put on your uniforms, suits, great dresses, if you look in the mirror, you confront the same issues that black judges struggle with. We ask ourselves, are we activist judges out trying to fashion our own law? Are we biased judges? Are we deciding a case in a particular way just because we're black? Are we deciding a case in a particular way because we don't want to be seen as just another predictable African-American judge? Are we really worthy of the titles we hold? Did we get this far in our professional careers just because we're black? But you know what? It is that struggle, that debate, that dialogue with myself that makes me look forward to putting on my heavy robe each day. For when judges reach the point where we feel our decisions don't matter, when we act rotely, when we lose touch with the fact that there are individuals out there in our courtrooms who deserve from us the highest quality of justice that we can render, who deserve courageous decisions grounded in the law and free from biases and fears and concerns about what other people will think of us, then we need to hang up our robes and we need to go ahead and ride on off into the sunset. And I hope that same struggle goes on with members of Noble. I hope that you ask yourself if you're doing the right thing. I hope that you question your motives. I hope that you question your conclusions. I hope you question your decisions and make sure that you are doing the right thing. And I want you to try to remember, as I do, that when we fail to make the courageous calls, then we abdicate our responsibility as holders of the public trust. For both black law enforcement and black judges, we must meet our responsibility to the future by remembering that we have been given a unique opportunity to sit at a table where a seat was denied to our foreparents for generations. We must make a difference when we occupy those seats. And it falls upon our shoulders to raise issues and to raise consciousness, and more importantly, to raise our voices. We must speak up, and we must speak out about unfairness in the justice system.
When we see a wrong out there, we must point it out. And we must bring attention to it. And we must make sure that things change. And if we're not able to do that, especially in these days of hope and optimism and cause for change, if we can't do that now, when a new day has already gone, then we should get up from the table that we have had the privilege of sitting at, and we should give our seats to someone who has the courage and the strength to do what is right. I've been privileged to serve as a judge in the Alameda County Superior Court for 17 years now, with a number of assignments and a number of ways to affect the lives of many people who come to that court system. I came to the position humbly after growing up very poor in Mississippi and coming out of being a graduate of Climbing High School in 1972, after being involved in our community, after a number of other challenges that I had to overcome, which I'll tell you about another day, but things were not easy. I've been given privileges and I've been given opportunities that I never dreamed that I would ever have. But I know as well as that comes a responsibility to this community, a responsibility to give back, and a responsibility to know that, to remember that those who did withstand the cause, and those who did withstand the I grew up in Mississippi. It was a traumatic event. I went through all of those segregated schools. So I know that I have to give something back and that we must be courageous. And what I found in all of these years is that we can acknowledge our history, and when we plan for our futures, our robes and our uniforms get noticeably lighter when we wear them. And we can go forth, and we can wear these robes, and we can wear our law enforcement uniforms proudly, and we can put on that badge, represents that badge of courage. And we can always, always know that we can wrap ourselves in the security of their strength when we're called upon to do the right thing. And I'm going to close now because I want to find myself in the same situation that another keynote speaker found herself in. And I'm told that after one keynote speaker gave a really long and probably 2 hour address, an audience member came up and said, you know, came up to shake her hand, and perhaps intuiting that the speaker might have violated a party rule of public speaking, which is that you should neither exhaust your subject nor your audience, the speaker asked, well, how do I do? And so the person said, oh, I like it just fine, but it seems to me that you missed several excellent opportunities. And the speaker, quite puzzled, asked, you missed several opportunities to do what? And the person said, to sit back. I'm going to sit back. And I'm going to thank you. And I do wish to thank you for letting me share this evening